The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Well, by my watch, it's 9:50. Oh, well, I should say by my Mac, it's 9:50, and time for us to begin. I confess immediately, I'm so disorganized, I don't even know when this talk is supposed to end. Can someone tell me? Are we scheduled until 10:50? All right. Well, that would be fine. Thank you for coming. This is so edifying to have a packed room for this talk. I assume it was the title that brought everybody out. I just want to talk about how, in fact, the heavens do declare the glory of God. My name is John Mays. I've been teaching at Regents for 15 years, and 16 actually. I just finished the 16th, and a few years ago started my own company publishing science curriculum, so that's me. This is a subject that I'm particularly attracted to. The more I read, the more there is to talk about, so I'll confess also right away at the beginning that this subject is virtually impossible because the entire universe is declaring the glory of God, right? There's no way we can even touch the topic in a one-hour talk. In fact, as we all know, this title comes from Psalm 19. So let's just read the first few verses. I always cry, in case you don't know that. At the FCL conference, it's sort of a joke, a public joke, that when John talks, he always cries. So if you've never seen me speak before and I start losing it, don't be embarrassed on my account, okay? I'm totally beyond embarrassment. But listen to the psalmist. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork day to day, pours out speech night to night. Can't even get started. Night to night reveals knowledge. Now, I love this next line. There is no speech. There is no, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. It's everywhere, all around us. So many ways the heavens are declaring the glory of God to us. So, as lovers of God, what we're going to do is just talk for a few minutes about some of these ways. I've given this talk a couple of times before, and I know that the subject is... I usually run right up against the time limit. I'm going to try not to do that, even though since last time I did the talk, I've added a whole bunch of new content and brought a bunch of things to read to you that I discovered in the last year of my own reading. So I'm going to skip through some things so we can get to some of these new things, too. So I'm going to move briskly. Hopefully we'll have time for questions and comments at the end. I'll try. There's many scriptures that speak to us, like the piece of Psalm 19 I just read. Psalm 104 very carefully describes the way God is so intimately involved in his creation. One of the things I love about Psalm 104 is... it explains what death is to us. What happens when a creature dies? According to Psalm 104, what happens is God takes its breath away. That's what happens. I asked my brother, who, in case you don't know, works with me in my company, and is in the booth down there right now. He has an MDiv, okay, so I don't. So he actually has studied theology formally. I asked him one time, long ago, Jeffrey, what happens when you smash an ant? What event just occurred in the cosmos when you crush an ant? And he said, a creature that gives glory to God by its sheer existence has ceased to exist. That's the way I think we should look at everything around us. Everything sings the glory of God. I don't think Christ's statement to the Pharisees, you know, if these didn't praise, the stones would cry out. I'm absolutely persuaded he was not speaking metaphorically. Okay? It's not a metaphor. Those stones have the capability, and in fact, do cry out. When you consider their crystal structures, the mathematical regularity with which they're composed, the amazing history of the earth and the way the minerals and continents and everything are formed so that life can be here, so that necessary nutrients and minerals will be distributed around, so that metals available in the hills for us to mine for human technologies. The whole planet is just stupefyingly ready for us. So ready for us. And the stones would cry out if Christ's disciples hadn't done so. This talk is so disorganized because there's no way to organize talking about the entire universe and how it glorifies God. So here we go, all right? Regularity in the seasons and all is just another thing. Evidence that God made this and that it speaks of his glory. Why should we expect an orderly cosmos to emerge out of a cataclysm? Okay? I'm not afraid of talking about the Big Bang. If you're a young earth creationist, that's fine. I'm not afraid of the Big Bang. When the Big Bang Theory emerged in the early 20th century, the first thing everybody said about it was that it was theological. Oh no, theology is coming into the science, because if there was a Big Bang, that means there was a beginning. There was a big person who caused that. And the astronomers went nuts thinking that astronomy was now going to be in the hands of the theologians. It's just ironic that it's around the other way now, where we're afraid to talk about the Big Bang. So if you don't like talking about the Big Bang, give me a little grace on that, and we'll love each other anyway. Here's a warning at the beginning of this talk. Here's a warning. This book is really fine, but by Alistair McGrath. It's a new treatment of what you might call natural theology. And in this book, he points out that in the past, theologians had the idea that natural theology could sort of be an apologetic that would enable us to prove God's existence by the order, in nature, William Paley and Watchmaker and everything. McGrath makes the point that the heavens declaring the glory of God is only obvious once you're already inside the community of faith. And in fact, one of my very best friends is a dyed-in-the-wool, give-no-quarter atheist. We talk every single week of the year, and have been for 10 years. He will not concede a single point. Which is why I put that last bullet point. Are belief and unbelief equally obvious? If belief seems obvious to you, if it seems obvious that everywhere you look, God is speaking to us in creation, just the mathematical order alone, existence of human intentionality alone, where could that possibly come from? To him, my friend, it's equally obvious that all of that is a product of chance. The ordinary evolutionary process that science can totally explain. So I just want to point out at the beginning, lest we get the wrong idea about a talk like this. This material is not something you can take to your atheist next door neighbor and say, see? Okay? But on the inside of the community of faith, it's a glorious subject. I think it's very important as we consider, as science teachers, as science lovers, as nature lovers, as lovers of God's creation, as just lovers of God who just like to bask in His works, His mighty works. I think it's important for us to remember to whom is the glory of God being declared. Who's the subject of this declaration? Right? Who's being spoken to? If the heavens declare the glory of God, who are they declaring it to? Well, obviously, to all that exists. The angelic beings, the principalities and powers, right? Everything is being declared to. But primarily, at least the purpose of Scripture is not to, it's not a book written for angels, right? It's a book written for human beings. This book written for human beings. So what the psalmist had in mind, I think primarily, is us. Well, then that raises a really interesting question, because now the nature of human beings, our born, built-in desire to learn and discover is part of the data set that's in front of us when we consider questions of science and faith. We are, in our nature, inclined to explore. It's inevitable that mathematics and technology and so on would develop in the course of human history. It was inevitable. It's in our character to discover. That next to the last bullet point there, if we are made by God and we bear God's image and we're made by God to explore and discover, and humans are inevitably going to do science in the world, what does that imply about what the world says of itself when we inquire of it? What are you and how do you work? Okay, I know God made the atoms. I know He made everyone. He hasn't told me how they work. That's up to us to learn. We can't know exactly how they work. They're too mysterious. I believe the ultimate knowledge is beyond human capability. We don't know what light is. Okay? All we can do is describe it. In fact, one of my favorite quotes is Niels Bohr, who said that the subject of physics is not what nature is. It's what we can say about nature. We can't know what it is. All we can do is learn certain things we can say about it. So I can say that light has wave properties. I can say that in other experiments it displays itself in particle properties. I can say that it exists in quanta and phase relationships and so on. I can say all these things. Okay, so fine. What is light? Having a clue, right? It's sui generis. It's a category all unto itself. There's nothing else to compare to it. Okay, so when we inquire about nature, we learn about the God who made nature. We learn His orderliness, His mathematical mind, because we see that in nature. So nature tells us about its creator. But, again, give me one moment of grace. I don't think that the idea that the earth was built with the appearance of age is consistent with the question, is nature telling us the truth about itself? Or how does it speak to us about God's glory? I know that the appearance of age idea is a common approach to try to bring reconciliation between the science that says the earth is 4.5 billion years old and the scripture, which many interpret to indicate that it is not that old. I know it's a common approach to reconcile those. But if the whole world was designed to look other than it is, that subverts the whole human enterprise of science. Right? What's even the point of figuring out radiometric dating and geological strata and learning all these things? What's the point if our conclusions are necessarily going to lead us in a false direction because the earth was built to look other than it is? So if you hold to that doctrine, I am not going to call you names. I want us to fellowship together and love one another despite that. However, I think this is a really important point to consider. If the earth looks young or looks old but isn't, then nature itself is not telling us the truth about itself. It's basically lying to us and leading us in the wrong way. But we are people designed to explore. It's built into our character. So there's this cosmic trick, big trick. We're born to inquire, and yet the material we have at our disposal to inquire is not going to cooperate. That recipe doesn't seem to make sense to me. So I find it much more fulfilling to find things in nature that help us more adequately fine-tune our theology, our hermeneutics of Scripture. Just like happened in the Copernican Revolution. The same thing happened then. Okay, I'm not going to dwell on the age of the earth thing for this whole talk. So if you're a young earth person, you can relax. I have plenty of other things to talk about. But let's move ahead. In the Aristotelian world, you know, the existence of things outside the realm of the earth was everything was regarded as pure and all that. It all had a philosophical beauty to it. But guess what? The actual universe where nuclear fusion is happening and stars is way more interesting than this sort of fairy tale, fake heavens idea that Aristotle gave us. So that's what that point there is. The second one on this screen, I read a couple of years ago the massive volume called The Anthropic Cosmological Principle by Tipper and Barrow, written in the mid-80s, and sort of a tour de force summary of all of the fine-tuning and everything like that that indicates that the universe was made for us, you know, that humans were the teleologically expected in terms of the universe. One of the points that they made, which I found very profound, which is another thing that leans me towards accepting things as their apparent age for what they are. Carl Sagan made the point decades ago that, oh, look, here's the Earth, this tiny blue dot, lost in the vastness of the cosmos, you know. Too bad for the humans who think we're so special. You know, because look at that. It's just a random planet in a random solar system. It's totally mediocre. There's nothing interesting about it. Ew. Why would God create such a vast and empty universe just so we can have these little special people on planet Earth? Isn't that silly? No, it's not silly. There's no other way that life, as we understand it, can function on this planet. Okay? There's so much that's necessary for life to thrive. From the nature of water, to the electromagnetic radiation that makes it here from the sun, to the DNA that we have in ourselves that's allowing genetic information to be transmitted generation to generation. On and on and on. There's so much. Okay, so why is the universe so big? Because that's how big the factory needs to be to produce a planet that has 192 naturally occurring elements on it, all loaded and ready to go for us to be here. Fred Hoyle, just not a Christian, but a man who was practically brought to Christ just by the sheer understanding he reached about how elements are formed in the stars. And the nuclear physicists, after they figured out that fusion is what's going on in the sun, and that star formation is also element generation, once they figured out, well, they can't figure out how you get past the first two elements. Like, how does carbon actually happen? It didn't seem like the energies and stuff would allow that to work. Carbon can't exist. And then Hoyle, working away, says, wait a minute. If it's this way, we do all the calculations, carbon does exist, there must be what he called a resonance occurring in these processes at the right wavelength, right energy, that would make carbon. And no one had ever detected that resonance before. But as soon as he said it has to be there, and they go look at the data, sure enough, it's there. It's a great discovery. But now we understand that stars make light elements in their first generation. Then when they go supernova, okay, and blow all their material out, then the second gen stars can do additional work and create heavier elements. All the while, the universe is expanding at this great speed. By the time you get stars that are old enough so that there's a material around with heavy elements that can come together to form a planet, which are necessary if life is going to inhabit this planet, okay? By the time all that happens, the universe will be 13 billion years old and will be this big, okay? So it's no mystery whatsoever that the universe is as gargantuan as it is. It's not, as Carl Sagan thought, a giant waste of space or an obvious thing that makes it obvious that there's no God after all because we just think we're special or not. It's not that at all. Human life can't be here unless the universe is as big as it is. This is just fantastically good stuff to me because it makes sense of everything. And now all of a sudden questions like, why are there so many stars? Why is the universe as big as it is and all that when we're just here on this one little planet? Yeah, well, we wouldn't have heavy elements here on this planet without those processes. Now, of course, once again, if you're a young Earth person, then all these things were just made by fiat. Boing. I think that so much more can be brought into our understanding when we stop being afraid of science and instead embrace it as proving our point for us. I mean, everything I read these days, it's another scientist, another philosopher who's saying materialistic Darwin, naturalistic Darwinism simply can't be the way it is. There's no way to get what we have from that. The mechanism is inadequate. So, we're totally on the winning side. And when you consider all this science can tell us about the universe, it does nothing but bolster our position as believers in the God who made it. This whole media campaign that's been going on for decades that science is leading us to disprove that there's a God, you know, all the way back to Hawking's original book, Brief History of Time, right, where he poses in the end of that book, which I read decades ago, that leaves very little room for a God. We don't even need God anymore. What a joke. The more science goes, the more we can't do without him. That's what this talks about, so I'll move ahead. I've already kind of talked about that. Oh, let's talk about this great thing I just read. There's a book by Robert Spitzer called New Proofs for the Existence of God. I was shied away from the book for a long time because I hate books with titles like that. It sounds like, oh, right, another quack who thinks he's going to prove God. I hadn't read Spitzer. Probably many of you have already know who he is. I didn't, so I didn't realize he's pretty serious. Anyway, in the book, he talks about Roger Penrose's calculation of the probability that all of the matter in the universe would be together at the Big Bang. Because this condition would represent essentially zero entropy. Okay, entropy is the natural progression of things towards disorder and lower energy as the universe expands. Second law of thermodynamics insists that entropy always must increase in the universe at all times. And ultimately, if we follow the logic, the universe will die its energy death, heat death, right? Which is why it's nice that God already has a mansion prepared for us some way that's going to make that not a problem. Not that we'd be around, of course, but... Now, if the universe started with a Big Bang, that means all of this matter and energy at some time in the distant past was all here in one place. That's the lowest energy state that you can conceive of. Well, what's the probability of that low energy, low entropy state coming into existence? Regardless of how you imagine it got like that, like bouncing universe or whatever. What's the probability that we have that? All right. Okay. This is not the number. This is me leading you up to the number. All right. So don't. We're not there yet. But we have to start here. Let's talk about what is the number 10 to the 123rd power. What is that number? Well, there it is. Right. A 1 followed by 123 zeros. It's a number that's impossible to imagine. But like I said, we're just getting started. So just brace yourself. Let's say the number. Here it is. This number is 1,000 trillion, 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 trillion. Because a trillion is 12 zeros, right? So all I have to do is say trillion 10 times and then 1,000 on top. Now, you ready? That's 10 to the 123rd power. What's this number? 10 to the power of 10 to the 123rd power. This is a number followed by 1,000 trillion, 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 trillion zeros. 1 over that is Penrose's calculation of the probability of the minimum entry precondition, which, if science is correct, actually was in place 13.7 billion years ago. That was there. And that 1 over that is the probability of that happening. Spitzer writes that this number is so big that if you were to write it down using 10-point font, writing down of this would occupy a significant portion of the known universe. A significant portion of the known universe would be filled up just with the paper that you write this number on using 10-point font. Now, my atheist friend who says there was a Big Bang, but it happened all by itself, okay? How? Numbers like that, okay, I don't care how many monkeys or how many typewriters, Hamlet is never coming out. And every time I say it to him, he says, well, you can't deny that the probability is not zero, that a monkey would randomly type Hamlet. No, friend, it's not zero. And neither is that. 1 over that is not zero either. Okay? But, come on. Alright, so this is called the anthropic principle, anthropic cosmological principle, that of course things look like they were designed for us to be here, because if they weren't, we wouldn't be here to notice it. So it's not really a remarkable circumstance at all. If things were other than they are, we couldn't exist, and we wouldn't be here noticing that they are the way they are. So, of course, they're the way they are. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here to talk about it. Yeah, well, that doesn't remove the mystery. It's still an explanation is called for. You can't just write off all these incredible numbers. All right, moving ahead, I want to share a couple of other things about the fine-tuning. All right, so let's touch up a couple of things here. Here's a statement by Paul Davies. If you haven't read him, you should. He's not a Christian. He's an Australian physicist who is not a Christian. And in every book he writes, he supports our point of view, all right? I think probably there's something about Orthodox Christianity that prevents him from coming, right? There's, for many people, there's problems like, why is there evil in the world, and why would a good God make us so much suffering and all, and that keeps many people outside the faith, all right? Because it's faith, right? It's belief. So, Paul Davies is not a Christian, but he is absolutely an ally of ours. Listen to this paragraph in his book called God and the New Physics. The numerical coincidences, like all the fine-tuning of the constants that have to be all just so, or else we can't be here, those coincidences could be regarded as evidence of design. The delicate fine-tuning in the values of the constants necessary so that the various branches of physics can dovetail so felicitously might be attributed to God. It is hard to resist the impression that the present structure of the universe, apparently so sensitive to minor alterations in the numbers, has been carefully thought out. It's very hard to resist the impression that's been carefully thought out. Why try? Right? Why try to resist? What's to be gained? All right. Is it hard to resist? Such a conclusion can, of course, only be subjective. In the end, it boils down to a question of belief. Right. Is it easier to believe in a cosmic designer than the multiplicity of universes necessary for the weak anthropic principle to work? Perhaps future developments in science will lead to more direct evidence for other universes. But until then, the seeming miraculous concurrence of numerical values that nature has assigned to her fundamental constants must remain the most compelling evidence for an element of cosmic design. Now, what he's talking about is this fine-tuning thing. In Spitzer's book, he itemizes a list of 20 constants in nature, all of which must, as far as we know, as far as scientists are presently able to say, they must have their present values to within a very small margin. Otherwise, none of the laws of physics and chemistry will work to hold things together and allow life to be here. Okay? Take the gravity or the mass of the electron or the charge or the fine structure constant. You just go down the list. There's so many of these numbers, and the physicists have all figured out that you can't change any of these numbers. If you do, even slide them out, then all the laws fall apart. Atoms can't even form or exist. Nothing happens. Nothing works. Can't have a universe. So what do we make of this? Okay, so the weak anthropic principle that Davies talked about would say that it's coincidental. And how do we justify this miraculous concurrence that Davies is talking about? Well, one way they do it is by saying, oh, well, there's an infinite number of universes because every time an atomic event occurs, quantum mechanics kicks in. There's these different possible probabilities of different outcomes, you know, from this event. And the multiple universes idea is that, well, both outcomes occur and a new universe forms, one in which outcome A occurred and one in which outcome B occurred. And so the multiplication of universes goes on at a rate equal to the number of atomic events that are happening in the universe at any given time, right? So that gives us this spectacular number of universes, inconceivable. Why even come up with such a dumb idea, is my thinking. Well, it's impossible even to consider or contemplate or know about. These universes apparently are isolated from us in a way we have no access to. So what Dave's talking about, future evidence of universes, there can never be such. Okay, that's the way you get around it. You get around the coincidence by saying, well, there's all these other universes that don't have our coincidences, and so we, of course, live in the one that does. Because only in that one can we even be here. All the other ones don't have all these coincidences. So see, it's not a miracle at all. Of course, we live in the one that has the coincidences, because we can't live in any of the others. Well, that's all real philosophically comforting and everything, but for crying out loud, why do we have to have this multiple universe thing to explain what's staring us right in the face, which is that the heavens are declaring the glory of God. To him who has ears, let him hear. Okay? Alright. I got to move ahead. I'm ahead on my notes, right? So I've already touched on some of these matters. I'm fascinated by the apparent infinitude of the universe in both directions, right? I mean, finite but unbounded in sort of a Einsteinian general relativity kind of way. So not infinite in terms of infinite space, but finite but unbounded. Oh, I just was reading Arthur Eddington this week explaining how to get your brain around this finite but unbounded universe. It's so good, I just have to tell you, because it's pretty sweet explanation. All right, imagine a circle, not a disc, but the rim, the perimeter of a circle. All right, imagine yourself as like an ant or something walking. You live in a one-dimensional space. You can walk this way, or you can go that way, and you can go as long as there's no boundary. You can go, you will never come across a boundary. You have one dimension in which you can travel, and there's no boundary in that dimension. Okay? That's a one-dimensional, unbounded space. Surface of a sphere. That's a two-dimensional, unbounded space. You can go north and south, or you can go east and west. And whichever you do, you can go all around and around or this way and never come to a boundary. There's no boundaries circumscribing where you can go. Now all we have to do is imagine the next dimension. All right? Imagine the same thing, but in three dimensions. Unbounded and yet finite. Just like the surface of a sphere in two dimensions is finite. It's only so much square footage. But it's unbounded. You can go on it without coming across the boundary. All you have to do is imagine the three-dimensional version of that. This is a hypersphere. But then he stops and goes, yeah, well, that's not it. Now you have to take the middle out. So you have the skin of a hypersphere. That's the unbounded, finite universe that we live in. All right, according to Einstein. Still, you might as well call it infinite. On the bottom end, we keep discovering new particles and stuff. And what are quarks made of? Are quarks made of other subquarks? Electrons, what are they made of? We don't know. We don't have a clue. No one even knows what an electron is. So the structure of the universe, I'm fascinated by, whichever way you look, the bounded, finite, hypersphere of space, the unbounded, finite, hypersphere of space, or the quantum, mysterious electron world of the subatomic. We're looking at mystery on both ends. And on both ends, we see the limitations. It's almost like the proud waves. Here your proud waves shall halt. Right? Here's human wisdom halts. We can't know the truth of nature. There's a reason. Because it was made by one who himself is infinite. Isn't it? Wouldn't it be expected that nature, its complexity, would be such that we can explore much of it and appreciate much of it and then finally come up against a wall at some point. I would expect that. If an infinite God made it, I would expect it to exceed my capacity to understand. That's an expectation. Not something to be frustrated about, something to celebrate. It's just another fingerprint of the divine. Another fingerprint is the existence of purpose in the minds of humans. Anthony Flew, British philosopher of religion who died just a few years ago at a very old age, 50 years, the most notorious atheist existence, okay? Way before Dawkins became famous for that, Flew was. He debated believers world round. His field was philosophy or religion. He was an atheist. But he had a motto that he adopted as a young man. I will follow the evidence wherever it leads. It just took 50 years for the evidence to lead him to Christ. And one of the things that did, it was science that did it. Okay? It wasn't science that proved there was no God. It's science led him to God. The last thing he did before he died, more or less, was write a book called There Is a God. On the cover, the word not appears in there, and the not is struck out with a red stripe. There is a God. Anthony Flew, right before he died, said, you know what? I said as a young man, I'm going to follow the evidence where it leads. Well, this is where it's led me. Where does purpose come from? Okay, imagine blind material evolving through the eons without purpose, without telos, without any goal for it. How does purposefulness emerge from non-purposeful matter and energy? He says, logically impossible. It can't. Purpose can only come from a purposeful being. Well, I think that's just one thing in the universe that can only come from mind. Right? Language is another one. I'm positive that when God made Adam and breathed in him the spirit of life and he became a living being, and it says he made them in his own image, I'm positive that part of that image, the imago Dei, is language. Because God in the Trinity, in the council of the Trinity, was considering in language and love were functioning in the Trinity. Right? The reason we have love and language, which cannot come from blind random forces, the reason we have them is because the one who made us has them. Right? They're tokens of his existence, because you can't explain what is any other way. I said I wasn't going to beat the drum of the old earth, but here's another just point. Annie Dillard, a lovely writer who I love to read, who was a professing Catholic for a long time, and now she describes herself on her website as a person who stays close to Catholicism. So pray for her. She's in her adulthood. She's struggling. But she's fascinated by nature. She's fascinated by the millions of parasites. Why do we have all these parasites? What she says in one of her books, what kind of madman would make a world like this? But see, the parasites, you know, it's not easy just to write them off and say, oh, it's the result of the fall. You pretty much can't have a functioning biology without them. How do you think your food gets digested? Bacteria, parasites in your gut. Okay? The world is full of millions of parasites. That's not a threat to theism. It's not a threat to the beautiful God. It just means this world is way more complicated than we dare imagine. Why is that frightening? All that means is that God himself is way more mysterious than I may have dared to imagine. My Sunday school classes might have injured me a little by persuading me that everything's very simple. Jesus loves me, this I know. And so all I have to do is grow up and have a cartoon Jesus and we're fine. Okay? And then you start reading and then you find out, whoa, everything's so complicated and why would God do this? But who is it? Pascal? A little science turns a man away from God. A lot of science brings him toward God or back to God. I think it was Pascal that said that. A lot of science brings him to God. That's what happened to Anthony Flew. Okay? That's also what's happening, although he won't admit it, to a guy named, I wrote Mind and Cosmos just recently, philosopher in New York, Nagel, Thomas Nagel, a little book. Just Mind and Cosmos, the subtitle is Why Darwinism, or maybe Naturalistic Darwinism, is Almost Certainly Wrong. In the first chapter, he says, I'm an atheist. I don't even want to talk to you about God. Do not write me letters. I'm not going to exist. I don't believe in God. That's not what I'm going to do. And in the rest of the book, he demonstrates that the presently prevailing naturalistic, Darwinistic, materialistic idea that's what's going on cannot possibly be the correct explanation of what's going on. And he concludes the book by saying, I don't know what's going on. There must be some feature of the universe that makes it like this, that gives us all the mathematical structure and order and the purposefulness and human consciousness. There must be something there that we don't know about yet that is responsible for these things. And we just need to redouble our efforts as good scientists and philosophers and get after finding out what that is. Wow, can we go back to page one, Dr. Nagel? Maybe that's the missing thing. And that's why you're being driven crazy, because you can't figure out how all this is the way it is. Because you've left out the fact that the celestial realms are beaming wisdom down on you night and day, and you will not hear what they have to say. Maybe that's the missing ingredient. It is, of course. Stephen Meyer's fantastic book, The Signature in the Cell, is another tome rolling out one chapter after another in which the science is giving us more and more evidence that the universe was very carefully crafted, just like Paul Davies doesn't maybe want to talk about. Paul Davies, by the way, does say in his books that he believes in some kind of transcendent being. He just resists identifying that being as the God of the Bible. Michael Benton has two books, one called Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, and the other one called Nature's Destiny. I read them both last year. Evolution, A Theory in Crisis is terrific. He doesn't deny that any evolution of any kind has occurred. The whole book, though, does deny that it happened, if it happened, that it happened by itself. And he shows one case study after another that statistically isn't going to arise by random chance mutations. And he talks about the avian lung versus the mammalian lung. Avian lungs that or floater, the air doesn't come back out the same way it went in. It's a flow-through lung. Yet birds supposedly evolved from reptiles, which have closed lungs, you know, in and out, same passageway. What? How did a closed lung evolve into an avian lung? How does that even happen? He points out the problems with it. In James LeFanu's book, Why Us? He points out majestically that we have this real tough problem explaining the emergence of humans, because 3 million years ago, maybe it's 1 million, anyway, 1 to 3 million years ago, the fossil evidence is that primates stood up, right? So we have fossil evidence indicating that, bipedal ape-like beings, you know, the original branch that was going to one day lead to humans, emerged. Okay, but it's all this really troubling mechanical engineering when the pelvis changes direction. Okay? You suddenly, simultaneously, in the evolutionary scheme of things, have to have giant muscles here, the gluteus maximus, to hold yourself up. Okay? You have to have your pelvis has to tilt. All the angles and joints and stuff in the bones all have to change. And guess what? Evolutionary evidence is that our brains were getting bigger at the exact same time, causing a real mechanical engineering train wreck when it comes to giving birth, because the region in the female pelvis where the baby has to come through is not big enough for a brain of, well, it used to be a little larger than it is now. Our brain is now about 1,352 centimeters. It used to be about 1,500, so they're, I guess, more efficient now or something, but they're still with very large heads compared to the size of the pelvis. And this brain evolution, which if it happened, I mean, I don't know if it happened, but if it did, it was God preparing the body for us. But it was happening right at the same time that we're coming upright. So we have to have a bigger pelvis with a bigger opening and tilted at a different angle for the different muscle structure. And both Denton and LeFanu point out in their book, this is just a calamity. All these things happening all at once. And you're saying it just happened like that. That by accident, we changed our pelvis so that we could change our brain, so that we could change the way we stand up. It all just happened, all roughly around the same time. And these two guys in their books basically laughed at that hypothesis that it happened by sheer survival of the fittest, you know, natural selection. Gives us everything. Natural selection explains everything. Well, it doesn't. And they, in their books, point that out. And Michael Denton's second book is Nature's Destiny. He points out from top to bottom, everywhere you look, this place is designed for us to be here. This is waiting for us to show up. Okay? Everything from the electromagnetic spectrum to the nature of salt, and particularly the nature of water, and so on and so on. Just thousands of things. And he lists them out and describes in great detail in that second book of his. Alright. Ta-da! Actually made it to the end with time to spare. Here's some resources. I listed there some of the titles that I have referred to. I think, did I put those resources in the notes that you have? Sorry. I'll leave that up there long enough for you to jot down what you are interested in, and leave it while we converse with our Q&A. GeoChristian.com is a blog run by a geologist friend of mine, Kevin Nelson, who is currently writing our forthcoming Earth Science test. And it is a old Earth website. And he has many beautiful friends who talk to him, who are young Earth creationists, and like to email him and ask him tricky questions, which he very graciously addresses on his website. He's one of the most gracious men and declines to engage in the frictional kind of confrontation that often surrounds that subject. So I commend that website to you. I especially commend it if you're a younger person. It will give you things to think about that are said in a way that's loving and charitable. Annie Dillard, those are two books that touch on the things that I've talked about. Pilgrim and Tinker Creek won, I think, one of the awards. Pulitzer, I think, when it came out. For the time being, is more recent, I think late 90s. They're both filled with wondering about the mystery that surrounds us on all sides, particularly as we encounter it in nature. Very good reading. I mentioned James LeFanu and Michael Denton's books, and there's the Robert Spitzer one, which I discovered at a Catholic conference a couple of years ago. I don't want to fail to mention the one at the bottom, David Bentley Hart, The Experience of God. I found about that book by listening to the Mars Hill audio journal that Ken Myers produces. He did an interview with Hart a year or so ago. That book is fantastic. David Bentley Hart is a philosopher, but he is a believer, and he realized some time ago that the new atheists, you know, the Dawkins Hitchens crowd, who like to write about the God delusion, he realized they're not talking about what we're talking about when we talk about God. But he also realized that from the evangelical Christian community, we too were often not talking about what the classical theological tradition talks about when it's talking about God. So it seemed to him that he arrived at this place where both the Christians and the non-Christians were talking past one another, and neither one of them was actually talking about the real God that exists. So he wrote this book to address that problem. So he says the book is really an attempt to reassert the orthodox classical theological tradition of who and what is God, and what can we say of him? What do we ascribe to him? But along the way, in reading this book, he tears the new atheists to absolute ribbons. And reading the book is just like, wow, I wish I could get my atheist friend to read this. He never will. But it's fantastic reading. I'm not quite finished with it. And I'm going to read it again immediately when I get to the last page. I'm just going to put it on replay. All right. Those are my prepared remarks. I'll be glad to spend a couple of minutes, what we have left here, addressing any questions or comments people might have on this subject. Yes, sir. Hugh Ross. I'm sort of a quasi fan, but not a full fan. And the reason is because I think I don't see any way out of our science faith dilemma if we insist that the Bible be a science book. I just don't think that's what the purpose of Genesis was. I don't think it's a science book. I think it was intended to communicate redemptive truth. God exists. God made all things. God made a people for himself. God is calling us to him. God is giving us a moral code and requires us to submit to it. That's what the book is for. And it's a description of redemptive history and the origin of that. If we accept that that's what the book is, then we need not freak out when scientific findings appear to contradict the scriptures. Because, in fact, they don't. The scriptures aren't there to give a scientific account. They're there to describe redemptive history. Okay? My one complaint about Ross, a lot of his work is great. My one complaint, because coming up with all the fine-tuning and describing all these kinds of things is great. But he still treats the book of Genesis as if it is actually scientifically describing what happened. And my problem is that if you do that, then it's really difficult to get out of the dilemma that you're in, that if you say, oh, see, the Bible does intend to convey scientific information, well then, what do you make of the appearance of the earth being old? So it's, I think, more satisfying to say this conflict need not be a conflict, because that's not why the Bible was written. And so that's my one thing about conflict. Yeah? Well, his question was, how can you be a scientist and being a Christian? Okay. Well, for starters, no human being is unbiased. Ever. So, since every human being has bias, all human beings have the same limitation when it comes to setting those biases aside to be able to do scientific work. So I don't really see that there's a problem. That's right. Well, I would argue the opposite. That as a Christian, I have tools at my disposal that an atheist scientist doesn't have. I, for example, believe that since God made the earth, and he made us, and he's a good God, and everything he made is good because he said it's good, that he intends for us to live on this planet in a harmonious way with the other creatures and with the resources that we have. Which means living in a way other than we presently live with a fossil fuel economy. That means I believe there is a technology. We just haven't got it yet. Maybe it's fusion. Maybe it's hydrogen, you know, that we get from bacteria that we can burn to get energy, which doesn't make anything except water. Maybe it's something like that. Maybe it's something else. But I believe those technologies are there. I believe there are structures in nature that allow us to live harmoniously on this earth. And if I were in that field of endeavor, I would search for them, knowing they're there. I know they have to be there. God would not have made us the way he did without it being like that. But as an atheist, I would have no ability to say they are actually there. I might search for technologies hoping to find something, but I wouldn't have any certainty that it was waiting. But I believe as a believer that everything we need is there. And as we explore and stuff, we can be confident that we will discover things that are good for us. Because they're there. It's a good creation. So I think that's an example of a way in which my faith would allow me to be a good scientist. It also it gives me abilities to... people always, you know, call this the God of the gaps thing, but how did life first arise? Let's call it the biogenesis, okay? Or the Big Bang. Where did that come from? As an atheist, I have no answer to that question. As a theist, I have no problem answering the question. How did life first arise? Well, we've been working on that question as scientists for 60 years. We've tried everything, all kinds of models, computers, blah, 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 lightning bolts. Yeah, the lightning bolts in the ammonia give us some amino acids or whatever. That's a firecracker from a self-replicating molecule, okay, which is all detailed out in Stephen Meyer's book, The Signature of the Cell, if you haven't read that yet. But as a believer in God, I got no problem. God brought the world to a state of completion where he was ready for life, and all the necessary chemicals were available. All we have to have is the initiation of the life. I think, I'm not afraid to say I think God did that. And my atheist friend would say, that's a God of the gaps argument. As soon as we discover how life arose, you will see that you'll have to eat crow on that question and just say, oh, that's how it happened. It can do it all by itself. Well, I'm not afraid of that. I tell them, okay, if you discover that, then I'll agree. Okay, you figured out a way for life to arise all by itself. But I'm really not afraid of that happening, because I believe life is too complicated for that to happen. So, as a Christian person who's a scientist, when I look into the intricacies of nature, I just see that they're declaring the glory of God to me, which is the title of the talk here. They're not random, uninteresting products of purposeless matter. So I think when it comes to bias, everybody has that, and I think that the advantages are on the side of the believer. Time is almost up, but let's just take one more brief question. Yes. You mean evolution or the age of the earth or both or everything else that I've talked about? Okay. Oh. Well, okay. Her question is, where do you address these sorts of matters in the curriculum of the school? The short and simple answer is, like, as with many things, there needs to be a long conversation with the students. So I think it's more of a matter of being immersed in an environment where these things come up all the time, which is why it's important for teachers like us to read and constantly prepare our minds so that we can participate with our students in these kinds of questions. And on that particular day when you've got 10 minutes left at the end of class and you finish your lesson early and all the kids are just sitting around, that's when you can say to them, okay, someone give us a tough question to talk about. And you just dive right in. And if this happens like in every classroom for 13 years, you know, at age-appropriate levels, of course, then the students, by living in an environment where these questions are addressed in an informal fashion, that is probably going to be, there are a couple of topics like the age of the earth, which you're going to talk about in earth science, and evolution, which you're going to talk about in your biology class, or a couple of specific places like that, but the larger question is just going to be part of our ongoing conversation. And a lot of my former students who have written back to tell me about their lives now as adults have said it was those informal conversations in your class that really made such a difference, you know, just in the way you talked. One student wrote in and said, I remember 9/11. I remember the day that you came in and started weeping about what just happened. And he said, you ever stop the lesson and pray? And she, because that's what I did when I saw her in the faculty lounge, the news, you know, showing the jet flying into the tower, all I could do was go back to my class. And she wrote in and said, you can't believe what a difference it made that you would walk in and just stop the class like that and pray with us. Because we're 15. We're afraid of this world. It's so scary. And seeing an adult who has faith, who just responds instantly in faith when things happen, she said, just watching that has it now informed me as an adult, just watching how you acted that day. That's how I think mostly these things are taught. It's just by the way we act. So I hope if you haven't come to our booth to see our materials that you will. And thanks for coming.
When you talk about the ancient and the older earth and stuff like that, help me understand your perspective. Because how do you line that up with where scripture talks about the days of creation? And also, if life was made, you know, millions of years ago, then what about that implies death before the fall, right? And those are questions that you've addressed. But how do you address those?
Well, for starters, these are really complicated questions, which have compelled many people to write many, many books, right? So I can't answer your question standing. But I can say, if you haven't read John Linus's little book, 7 Days to Divide the World, that would be a good place to start. It's very short, and he addresses the question of the theological implications of an older Another place I can direct it to is to an article that is available on our website that my brother wrote just last month in our newsletter. It's called Does Genesis Require an Unearth or something to that effect? It's about 6 pages. And if you go to our website, that's our email, but the domain is in there. NovariTimesAndMath.com. Just circle that part. And go to the newsletter tab and get the latest one, a PDF that you can get. And he addresses the very questions you've asked. As far as death, he doesn't address death before fall. That's not part of his objective. But the days and the nature of the text and things like that, Jesus text he addresses. I don't think he addresses the day thing too much. Maybe briefly. It's more like the nature of the text and so on. But Linus addresses the days in his book.
What's his book called?
7 Days That Divide the World. It's the best short treatment.
The guy that debated Dawkins.
He's a British mathematician.
Yeah.
And a lovely Christian.
Yeah.
Well, 7 Days That Divide the World. Very clever title. Just a couple more things. A longer treatment written by 2 Christian geologists who were teaching at Harvard is The Bible, Rocks, and Time. It is sort of an exhaustive treatment of the entire history of evangelicalism and their association with Young Earth theology.
Mm-hmm.
And he covers the subject in quite a lot of detail. Scarily and the 2 authors. I think one of them maybe is Davis and the other is Scarily. But The Bible, Rocks, and Time is the title. And it gets into the details of the geology and everything else. The death before the fall thing, my short answer to that is the Bible statement in Romans 5 I hate to refer to.